Elizabeth, it's lovely to be with you all this afternoon. I'm seeing so many familiar faces, so it's always a little bit like old homes week. I'm really pleased today to be joined by our fabulous panel to continue the discussion that we've been having on the findings and recommendations of the MDIS review. I'm sure, like me, all of our panel have been busy poring over the report, and nothing like a weekend with an NDIS review report, and possibly a glass of wine, but I didn't confess that, okay? And getting in touch with the detail behind the 26 recommendations and the 139 actions. I think having a chat with people in the break and just generally, you know, I think it's clear to me from the report that the panel had actually listened to people with disability and the sector throughout the review. And I think that's not just been to the issues that we've raised, many of which have been really long-standing, but also to some of the ideas about how these can be addressed, what some solutions are to those issues. Throughout the NDIS review, our members and NDS have asked the panel to avoid the tinkering around the edges that we've seen previously, and to instead focus on some of the fundamental reforms required for the NDIS to be the best it can be. Whether we agree with every proposal, whether we think the detail's right, whether we would have liked to have seen more or less, I think we can agree that Bruce and Lisa and the rest of the panel really rose to that challenge. They provided a comprehensive range of recommendations, and that do provide a roadmap and some a chart, I think, for a way forward for government and the sector. So, on that note, I'd like to go over to all of our panel for their thoughts, for their first reflections. And I'm going to kick off with the same question for all of them. We've got the lovely Elle down in front of us, so if we are looking a little bit down here, it's just so that we can see Elle as well. So from each of your perspectives, you've been engaging with the NDIS review like we have since it began. In the context of the report and the work that the three of you have been doing today, what are your initial reflections? We're going to start with Mark, then we're going to go to Elle, and then we'll finish up with you. So over to you, Mark.
Thanks so much. Firstly, thanks for the opportunity to have this discussion. I've been lying awake at night thinking about the report, and it's nice to have people to discuss it with. It's very therapeutic. my kind of visceral reactions are some excitement, some hope, but also a fair amount of anxiety. I'm very pleased with how grounded in an honest view of the problems the report clearly is, and I can see a lot of compatibility in the recommendations, the type of things I've been in favour of. But as I'm reading, I'm finding my mind inevitably, when I read a certain recommendation, goes to my own personal situation, and I have that thought, hang on, what would this actually mean for me personally? And I think a lot of participants will, as we're digesting the review and having the discussion over the next while, we'll have that thought, and providers will be thinking, hang on, what specifically does this mean for our organisation? So the anxiety comes from how in the implementation will this actually look.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And I think we can safely say you've found your peeps here. Like, you know, we're all really into discussing what's in the NDIS review, so feel free. Over to you, Elle.
Thanks, everyone, and thanks for having me with you here today. And yes, I feel like I've definitely found my other people who have been spending the weekend reading the review. So, look, for me, it was really important that the review really tackled one of those big unfinished businesses from the Productivity Commission 10 years ago, which is the foundational supports, is that new piece of jargon that we're all going to be very familiar with very shortly. But it is that the kind of infrastructure for disabled people outside of the individualised support plans in the NDIS. And it has been not only undone over the last 10 years, but almost in lots of cases got worse for so many of us, where those individualised supports, there's like nothing else. And I'm not going to use lifeboats or oases or anything of that like that. But I think that the National Cabinet Agreement in particular, the day before, was so critical to how we can take the review forward, and particularly around building a broader landscape for people with disability that is not so accessible. So for so many of us outside of individualised supports, for those of us outside the NDIS, there's just nothing. And so it has made it extremely difficult to engage with the world. And so I think that that's really a really important part. I think someone will talk later about some of the changes to access and planning and budgeting, which I think are also really important. But I want to also flag that they've mostly listened to people with disability, and I like that there were three times as many engagements with disabled people as there were with the original Productivity Commission review. I know that Dana has and our members worked incredibly hard over the last year, and many of the other disability representative organisations did the same, to make sure that not only disabled people like me got heard, but disabled people who live in closed settings in places that they don't often have their voices heard. And the review did work really hard to listen to a really wide range of disabled people. And I like that there is a lot of attention paid to building an infrastructure for First Nations disabled people in particular, and I think that would be incredibly important. I also just want to flag that like Mark said, there is significant anxiety around some key aspects of the review. I think registration in particular is causing a great deal of concern for people, the shared supports and what that will look like in practice, and then how things like choice and control will be preserved, particularly for people who employ their own support workers. So I just want to flag that, but I'm really glad to see things like unregistered SIL in particular getting a kind of significant attention around the urgency of dealing with that and making sure that there is some alignment between the review and the Disability Royal Commission. And I know that the review actually went further than some of the recommendations in the Royal Commission, say around restrictive practices, for example, and so I was really pleased to see that.
Great, thanks, Elle. I've just had a little reminder for us all, if we could just speak a little bit more slowly. So this is a case of doing as I say, not as I do, because I do have a very tendency to kind of go hell for leather. So just a little reminder to speak a little bit more slowly for all of us, and I'm going to hand over to you now, Hugh.
Thanks very much. Like the others, I thought DNDIS review report was good. I think it was pretty faithful to the original design of the NDIS and sort of trying to put power and choice control to people. I quite liked quite a few things. So one was the push to quality and that idea that we should be trying to understand outcomes and how it's making a difference rather than just sort of just volume. I think sort of that came through in the report. I do think that when you talk about individualised plans, tailored plans, there is a need for sort of that functional assessment. And so that was obviously in the report, and I think you can't have good plans without a good understanding of needs. So I think those two do go together quite well. I really liked the emphasis on fairness and equity in the report too. So sort of I'm a data guy, so we look at a lot of sort of NDIS data, and it's very hard to tell why some people have very large packages and why some people don't. In many cases, I'm sure it's the right decision because there's some underlying need that hasn't been reflected in the data that's been tailored for. But sometimes, and I think the review makes this point, is that sometimes those differences are just inconsistencies in how the NDIS is applied at the planning stage or other bits and pieces. So I do like that as something that probably needs to happen as well. And as a data guy, I do like the emphasis on sort of measurement and data and outcomes, and I think that's sort of there. As something that you do need for ongoing sort of monitoring of how you're going. Lots of things to make people nervous as well. Certainly the pace of change is a hard one and comes back to that Goldilocks question I think we had before, that a lot of things are quite urgent, but you can't go too fast as well.
Thanks, Hugh. So we've just got the top of mind first reflections from our panel, all from very different perspectives. I'd like to invite you as we're going along to add some questions as well for us to ask our panel to explore. And you can do that via the live stream under the Q&A tab. So please take your opportunity to ask some questions and we'll get to some of those as soon as we can. You touched on outcomes and I'd like to stick with you for a minute. Taylor Fry, she said you're a data guy and you're surrounded by data guys and girls, I imagine. We're just wondering about, you've done a lot of analysis, and I'm just wondering about, what you're actually seeing in terms of the numbers and what they're telling us about the results of investing in better supports and inclusion more generally. So I know you've done some work for the Royal Commission, you've also done a report that is up on the NDIS review website, which is around quantifying costs and benefits of the NDIS. So really interested in your thoughts on investing in better supports and inclusion more generally, and how do you think the recommendations from the review are balancing those two sides of the same coin?
Thanks very much. I'll try and cover a lot of ground quickly and hopefully not scare too many people, but we did a report for the Royal Commission. And it was around the economic cost of violent abuse, neglect, and exploitation of people with disability. And so one reason you do those reports is to come up with a big number, and we came up with a big number, so $46 billion per year. But the real reason you do those reports is to try and understand in what ways you have this sort of maltreatment. And one thing that was quite interesting was that two-thirds of that figure wasn't related to interpersonal maltreatment, so people sort of being subject to violence or the like, but it was actually systemic factors, so systemic issues in health or in justice or in employment or in disability services that meant that people were actually really suffering and there was economic harm attached to that as well. And I think that in one way is scary, but encouraging, that means that at a policy level there are things that can be done to improve the picture. So that's a big number, and for what it's worth, bigger than the cost of the NDIS. We did another review for the NDIS review, and that was around the net costs and the net benefits of the NDIS. So that's a tough question. On the net cost side, maybe that's the easier side, where we were able to say, well, of the $35 billion cost of supports in the NDIS, roughly half of that is new money that wouldn't have been there under legacy schemes. And of that, maybe half goes to additional supports to people who used to get support under legacy schemes, and the other half goes to people that did not have support before. So understanding that is useful. On the benefits side, we were really looking through employment and education and health and trying to understand in what ways people's lives are better, both people with disability and their families and carers. A little bit different if people are familiar with the per capita report, which was very much an economic growth sort of argument, so how much does the NDIS contribute to that growth? But we're really sort of focusing on outcomes for people with disability and their families and carers. And we found some things, certainly, so subjective wellbeing was a little bit higher, and that was actually the bulk of the benefit that we're able to measure. There were some small gains in reduced hospitalisation, some small gains in employment for both participants and carers. And beyond that, a lot of things were actually quite hard to measure, so we either found nothing, and in some cases that's because the data's not there. In some cases it's because of time factors, so people who are getting early intervention supports, maybe we don't see those benefits yet, but it does suggest that some combination of sort of making sure we are sort of banking outcomes for the money that is being spent, as well as actually making sure we can measure those well, I think, will mean that we can do a better job next time around.
Yeah, thanks, Hugh. I mean, I do think that's important, isn't it? You know, it's kind of one of the things about how do we get better at actually measuring that and changing some of the narrative, I think, around cost and benefit more broadly. And I think you were saying, in terms of measuring those direct outcomes, but that broader benefit in terms of wellbeing, community capital, those kind of things. Mark, I'm going to ask you a question a bit about innovation, but I know in your report, you did talk a little bit about the importance of you know, keeping the community really engaged with the NDIS and their overwhelming support on that. And I guess being able to have some of those discussions or those conversations about, yes, there's a cost, but man, there's a benefit, are important. So if you could just touch on that, and then I might just quickly come back to you for a question around innovation, if that's okay.
I think part of the genius of the initial NDIS campaign, the Every Australian Counts campaign, is that concept that the NDIS is there for people who currently have a disability. The subtle kind of message behind it is kind of all the way either any of us could acquire a disability in the future, or if life had gone differently, anyone could have been in the situation where they had a disability, or someone in their family had a disability. And I think when the discussion is anchored in that sense of what would I want if I were on the other side of this, that really unlocked something quite special. And I do feel like there's some signs that the general Australian culture to disability has changed a bit as a result of that campaign and as a result of what the NDIS has done over the last few years. But I've forgotten the main point of your question. Where I'm on a tangent.
No, that's perfect. And I think it is about that, you know, thinking, you know, what would I want? What would that look like for me or my family member is really powerful. And I think we, you know, going back to some of that discussion, you know, is important. What I was going to ask you a little bit about was just innovation. So, you know, providers tell us that regulation and pricing, it's in our State of the Sector report and has been for a number of years, are just not conducive to innovation. And you do talk a little bit about, you know, that they do go hand in hand. You know, we've got sustainability and innovation, hence the theme of the conference, a sustainovation. Just wondering what you think is needed to support innovation or incentivise that. And following on from that is, how do you see the recommendations in the report, or at least some of the recommendations in the report, addressing that and thinking about what might those incentives look like?
The point about sustainability and innovation, obviously, if the scheme collapsed, there could be no innovation. But there is, in business world, which I'm not really a part of, you hear people talk about business confidence. From the politician's perspective, that's the most important, one of the most important things, that businesses feel confident. I think we could talk about that a bit more in terms of people with disability and families as well. In terms of our role in innovation and our willingness to suggest innovations that we'd like to see happen and to trial new models of housing, new models of support. I think it's not so much about creating incentives for innovation. I mean, from a participant's perspective, there's an intrinsic incentive to want to make the most of the life you have, make the most of the abilities you have, and participate in the way you want to participate. Don't need much more incentive than that. But the NDIS, I think, has, as it is currently, created perverse incentives where the feeling of, could my plan be ripped out from underneath me if I'm seen to be improving, or if or you know, doing more? Or do I need to save my energy? Instead of trialing different models of support, I need to save my energy for the plan review fight. I think that severely undermines our willingness to try some other things. So in this new design, I think there's the separation of the allocation of funding and the working out of how do I put that to the best use for me seems to be the idea of separating that. I think that's a really good idea and a fundamentally important thing. We've got to be careful that other perverse incentives don't sneak in. Many of the things that I now think are big problems, I was a big supporter of back 10 years ago, and it took me by surprise how things played out. So take everything I say with a grain of salt.
It's funny you say that, and most people in the room would know Dougie Hird, and I've also heard him reflect on a similar thing, is what we thought we were getting ended up into something a little bit different, and there's a whole range of reasons why that's happened. Elle, that's a perfect segue to you. I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about, you know, what you think those changes to access, budgeting and planning processes like might mean for participants and for the providers that support them in, like, practical terms. So we know that the review came out early with some ideas around that, but just interested in your reflections and also whether you wanted to pick up on any of that innovation discussion that Mark was just leading us off on.
Look, I was thinking while Mark was talking about a project I did last year about employment for people with intellectual disability, and something that people said, disabled people and their families in particular said a lot of was, we keep trying to innovate, but the NDIS is doing everything they can to stop us. And it was a really key theme around the stakeholder engagement that we did, where they would try to do things around micro-enterprises and a whole bunch of really creative solutions around employment for people with very significant support needs, but the NDIS would say, well, now you don't need employment supports anymore, and the whole thing would fall apart. So I think the changes to the access and planning have been thought about with thinking about some of those examples and how to give people with disability and their families a bit more trust and a bit more creativity with their plans over a longer period of time. I was part of the co-group, which was tasked with looking at access and planning right from the beginning. And as we kept getting told, don't think of the current system, make, you know, start from the beginning, think of something completely new. And I'm not sure we succeeded in doing that, but we certainly did try and take, if we could make a perfect system, one that worked for us in and for as many people with disability as we could think of, how do we design that? So I think the navigator role really came from that, of having someone who could be a champion of people with disability who is outside the provider system. And providers absolutely provide services and that's fine, but in terms of navigation, information, someone independent to talk to, that was really talked about, particularly from people with intellectual disability and families, that they just didn't have anywhere to go to find out what was best and what was, you know, new. Because as Mark said, sometimes when people come into disability, it can be because the worst thing in the world has happened to them and their family. So it can be a time of shock and trauma, and so finding information is really important. So that was really good. With the access, we were very keen to not repeat independent assessments, and as I've said to a large number of people in the last week, I was one of the people who fought the hardest against independent assessment. So the idea that I would ever sign off on something that looked or smelled like independent assessments is not correct. So to really make the assessment process much fairer, much less dependent on having the right words or the right reports or being able to access a diagnosis or any of those things that are increasingly challenging, and particularly challenging in regional areas and for families who come from low socioeconomic background. And we know that the NDIS is absolutely life-changing for people in those circumstances if they can get in. And then for the budgeting and the planning processes to be separate. So for people to have a broader package of supports that is not done by the line item, you know, this particular thing can only be spent on this and can't be spent on anything else. Because people talk to us a lot about that creating really significant challenges as they were going forward. So part of the whole access conversation is also about, do you need an individualized support plan, or, you know, in our idealistic world that we get to in 5 years' time, will the foundational supports available widely in the community be, you know, able to meet your needs and meet the needs of your family member? And that's part of access shouldn't just be about in or out and, you know, that hard line between being in the NDIS or out, but actually about what supports do you need and how do we best meet your needs, particularly for kids. And I think that's one of the core changes around this that I'm most pleased about, but it really starts to erase those really hard edges between support and no support that have caused so much harm.
Yep. Thanks, Elle. I mean, when we were chatting beforehand, just to take you back to that budgeting and flexibility recommendations, I mean, certainly when I've been speaking with people, that's been one of those that's been greeted with a, how does that work in practice? Just wondering whether you want to talk a little bit more about that, because I think when we were preparing for the session, you were talking a bit about how that relationship negotiation discussion might play out between people with disability seeking services and the providers that they're approaching and working with around that.
Yeah, and I think it's something that I know, Mark, in your report with Simon Duffy, you talked a lot about how do we build capacity of people with disability and their families to feel like they're in control of their budgets and that it belongs to them and that they have a sense of ownership over it to be able to then make longer term decisions about it. So to be really, you know my feelings about being consumers in the marketplace, but to be in that position of having a bit more power, to be able to go out and say, yes, I want this service, no, I don't want this service, I have a range of options, and I can have choices that will actually deliver me the kind of life that I want. Instead of what it is now, which has been that those kind of really granular sort of line items that you get presented with a really quite narrow range of options of providers that you could actually go to. And so I think that this was part of the original design, and it is the design of a lot of individualised funding systems. It was part of the original calls from the Attended Care Coalition in the 1990s in Australia. Like, there's been a really big push from disabled people and families to have this ownership and power sitting with them as part of how we develop this. And it hasn't realised for many people. For some it has, but for most people in the NDIS, it hasn't been realised. And so I do think that these changes, if we do it properly, and there is quite a lot in there around supportive decision making, about building capability and capacity in people with disability and families, and those independent information. Of course, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't say more money for advocacy, and making sure that there is that sort of independent, you know, sort of ecosystem around them to guide people into doing that. And I think there's been some good mention around peer support and some of that as well, which is, again, one of those missing pieces that was part of the original Productivity Commission design.
Yeah, thanks, Elle. I'm going to stick with you, and then got a question around, I'm going to come to Hugh with another question around outcomes, if that's okay. Just wanted to talk a little bit about how you see the recommendations generally, moving us from a focus on that quantity of support. So, you know, we've definitely heard from providers that, you know, it's a very transactional system that we've got now. There's so much focus on hours, input, not enough on outcomes, hence me coming to you in a minute here. How do you think they're going to move us into that different focus, more on the quality of what people are receiving?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think what is quality support is not that actually that difficult a question. We kind of know what that is. There has been plenty of research. People with disability know what good quality support looks like. We have the entire Disability Royal Commission that's made some really strong recommendations about that. So I don't think it needs to be a mystery about what quality support actually looks like and what people with disability, particularly people with an intellectual disability, keen to do, you know, a lot of the time it is just what everybody else wants to do too. It's to live in the community, to do the kinds of things that they want to do, have a job, live in a house that they have control over. And as people with intellectual disability have said to me, you know, be able to make a sandwich if I'm hungry at 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, that is a really good indicator around choice, as they say, choice and control. But the pricing paper that was put up by the review and, you know, the review itself was really clear that in the current system, there isn't any mechanisms to provide incentives for providers to do that. And in fact, the incentives exist in the opposite direction. So the more support that someone can get, that's better, whatever quality it is, there is no differentiation. So I do think that we need to engage people with disability first and foremost and their families around what is that quality and then how do we actually deliver it. And I think we, you know, to be frank, I think we should start with people with an intellectual disability because today they have experienced the least quality, you know, in terms of services and the least qualities in terms of outcomes. You know, we've just had the 4.5 years of the Disability Royal Commission making really strong findings about what life is like under the NDIS for people with the most complex support needs. And we need to make sure that they're not still living lives, you know, that are segregated from the community in another 10 years' time. So I think that it would be really helpful to work with people with an intellectual disability around how do we design that and do that. And some of that is going on right now. And I think that there are providers who are working with peer support organisations, working with people who lived in institutions and group homes all their lives about what does home look like for you and where do you want to live and how do you want to do that. And I think those kinds of partnerships where people with disability and families and providers work together to say how do we do this and how do we build this kind of new way of doing things, I think is absolutely the way of the future.
Yeah, thanks, Elle. I'm just going to leave right on to Hugh before I lose my train of thought. I was just interested in, so, we, you know, we're talking a little bit about, you know, lots of one-to-one quality discussions and what's working for individuals. How do we scale that up? So if we're, like, embracing what, you know, Bruce and Lisa were talking about in terms of, you know, you listen, you adjust, you measure, and then you do it better, how do we kind of start to measure some of that and turn that into that kind of continuous improvement that we all want to see? And if we're trying to help people make decisions about, you know, about the supports that might be the best quality, best value for them, deliver the best for them, how do we measure that and how do we get that info out there? Just a small question for you, Hugh. You can thank me for that one later.
Yeah, no worries. I think there's always challenges and like, it's easy to say, oh, we should just collect better data and sort of do it better. And I am very conscious that sort of that's red tape and burdens on providers and other people that collect such data. So you do have to balance that with actually doing the work that needs to be done. But I think in general, there's the opportunity to have tighter relationships between the goals and the needs of participants, the spend that's attached to that, and then the outcomes achieved. So it's not something that I've seen done super well to date, that sort of actually sort of being able to articulate these are the people that had particular education goals or employment goals or other types of goals. These are the specific supports that sort of help support that. And these were the outcomes that are achieved. But that is sort of the nirvana state where you can actually sort of both demonstrate the value that providers are adding, but also, I guess, sort of building that evidence base about what works and sort of then sort of doing more of what seems to work. One of the other big challenges in outcomes, and I guess it probably is heightened because of the emphasis on foundation supports, is that currently the main outcomes sort of system for the NDIS is within the NDIS, so the annual survey of people. And this has challenges when you want to see, well, what are outcomes like for people in the NDIS and not in the NDIS? And that question, I think, will become more and more relevant over the coming years. So it does actually mean you need to sort of broaden how you think about outcomes. There's been a bit of a push with the Australian Disability Strategy has its own outcomes framework. There's the National Disability Data Asset, which is hoping to sort of pull together different types of information. So if you do that well, I'm reasonably optimistic it can be done well. You'll actually be able to see sort of
outcomes that you weren't able to see before, as well as do that comparison. And in terms of sort of new outcomes, actually sort of being able to see improved incomes or improved employment or better outcomes with the justice sector, I think a lot of those types of questions are not sort of well understood at the moment.
Thanks, Hugh. Sort of a little bit kind of similar, but going to you, Mark, just, you know, overall, you took particularly in the report that I'm referring to, you know, you and your colleague, Dr. Simon Duffy, took a really holistic and optimistic view of the NDIS and the potentials and opportunities for reform. I think one of the things that struck me, and it does go a little bit to those outcomes questions and some of the things that, you know, Hugh and your colleagues found, particularly in terms of the Royal Commission report and, you know, systemic maltreatment and, the you know, making changes in systems and what that could achieve for us. You and Simon talked a little bit about how we can avoid implementing what you call downstream solutions to upstream problems. Might ask you to talk a little bit about what you meant by that, and then just whether you think the recommendations are going to the heart of those issues.